I try to help them understand what went wrong. A lot of questions. I mean, they themselves, believe it or not, they've committed these awful crimes, and they're often wondering, looking back retrospectively, what the heck happened?
All right, Michael. Michael, where'd you grow up? You grew up in Rhode Island?
Yeah, I grew up an Italian-American family in Providence, Rhode Island, the outskirts, Dyer Avenue, Pocasset Ave, which is known as the Silver Lake area, until I was a teenager. And your typical Italian-American loud family, born in the 70s, grew up in the 80s. As a kid, I remember visiting my dad in prison. That's probably one of the things that really made an impression on me. I think really set me up for what I do now. Although in Italian families, we don't say prison. We say school. So I'd say, Mom, you know, where are we going? She'd say, we're going to go visit your father. I said, where? She said, school. I said, what's he in school for? She said, law. And in fact, my dad will still say today, you know, when I went to law school, and I'll say, Dad, you're not a lawyer. You have lawyers, but you're not a lawyer. So I remember visiting him as a kid when he was in prison. And, you know, that made an impression on me. I think what also made an impression on me is that my dad, you know, without divulging any of his deeds, that's his story to tell, but he was involved in a certain life. And I knew him as my dad. He was adventurous. He was fun. He took me a lot of places, went to Disney. But then in the neighborhood, he had a certain reputation. In fact, I even remember as a young kid, maybe about 7 years old in the playground, and a girl named Gina approaching me and saying, I would be afraid to live with your dad. And that moment, I just thought to myself, what does she mean? Right away, I began to see that there was this gap, if you want to call it that, between a man's persona, how he's perceived by the masses, and then who he really is. And I love my dad. I grew up, my mom was young when she had me. She was 16. And they were both, you know, they were both involved in some things. I'd be honest with you. I kind of come from a family of outlaws. I seen some things as a kid that probably most kids shouldn't see. I mean, I remember being in the bathtub at a young age, playing with those big rubber wrestling dolls, you know, the Hulk Hogan, Iron Sheik, like 1980s, and the bathroom door is shut, and I hear my mom yell. I don't know why she's yelling, but I hear her yell, he's not in there. And the next thing you know it, police officers kick in the bathroom door. They've got their guns on me. I'm in the bathtub. I'm a little kid. And my mom, just maternal instinct, I mean, it's not something that she thought about clearly, but she's on top of the cop. And she's like clawing his eyes out. I mean, which, Ma, you could have got me killed. But she loved me. She was a good mom. My dad was a good dad. I just, you know, they were involved in some things and seen some things I shouldn't have saw as a kid. I remember my father's close friend. His name was Joey. This is a guy that was around our house a lot. He would take me to the park. He'd put me on his shoulders. And then the next thing you know it, Joey's gone. He's not around. It's like, what happened with Joey? And I remember my family talking about it in the kitchen. It was just common conversation. Here I am, a child. Obviously, nobody read Dr. Spock's book on child rearing. And they're saying things like, yeah, Joey, they shot him. They dismembered him. All they found was his torso. They could identify the body because of the tattoo on his chest. So these events, they make an impression on you. I think one of the things it did is it raised my threshold for insanity. Here I am today, 48 years old, and I work with some of the most violent people in the prison system. I've sat with serial killers. I mean, when I say sat, I mean face-to-face, intimate, personal relationships. I think that those experiences gave me a compassion. In fact, that's one of the things I love about this show, is there just seems to be an elevation of empathy in a society that is bankrupt of empathy. And when society loses empathy, that's a scary thing. I could, as a PhD in behavioral science, I could talk to you a lot about the importance of empathy and how it short circuits violent impulses And when we lose empathy, when we lose that ability to really know someone, it becomes a lot easier to hurt them. So one of the things I love about Soft White Underbelly is that I think it elevates empathy. It gets us to see other people's stories. So I had this empathy, this compassion from the time I was a kid, you know, towards my dad. I loved him. Towards some of the people that he knew that he was involved with. And I went down the wrong road for a while. As a teenager, I got in some trouble. I was in and out of institutions. At my 17th birthday, I was locked up in juvenile jail. I can look back at that time, and for a lot of reasons, I mean, you can't really boil it down to one thing why people do what they do. For quite a few reasons, I was lost. I mean, absolutely lost. I look back at some of my writings in my journal at 17 years old, so rabid, so pathological in my thinking, even bordering on violence. I mean, at that time, I was robbing houses. I robbed a cop's car with two friends, if you can believe that. I mean, that's crazy, but then there's crazy with a Q, crazy. That's a whole nother level of crazy. And so we were crazy. You know, we break into this car and we find out it's a cop's car after breaking into it. We see all the equipment. It was an unmarked Toyota Camry, 1991. And I remember getting in the car. It was no big deal. We took the car and went on this joyride and robbed houses and ended up in juvenile jail and just an absolute mess, you know. And then in juvenile jail at 17 years old, there was a pastor who came in to the prison. In fact, he just passed away about 2 years ago. His name was Mike Krautman. And Pastor Mike had a heart of compassion for the scoundrels. I mean, just for the down and out. And I remember him sharing the gospel with me. And I heard the gospel. I didn't give my life to Christ there in that juvenile jail. But as soon as I was released, probably within 6 months, somebody invited me to church and gave my life to Christ. And the last 30 years, I went from pastoring a church of 16 years. Our church was a hospital for the sick. I mean, it was inmates getting out of prison, helping them reacclimate to society, 12-step support groups. I mean, we were the church that said, God send everybody that nobody else wants. We were the church of the outcasts. And in the process of pastoring, I decided to pursue the PhD. I'd already gotten the bachelor's and the master's. And I wanted to understand what makes people tick. Like, why do they do what they do? You know, what was going on in me, in my head at 16, 17? Why was I so angry? You know, where did all this come from? You know, you answer that question, that's not like a simple answer. I mean, one thing you've got to be careful for is known as causal reductionism, which is to reduce a very complicated phenomenon to one single factor. It would almost be like playing the game Jenga and the tower collapses and you blame the last block. Well, the collapse of the tower is a buildup of blocks. And it was a buildup of blocks for me. I mean, I think back on my childhood, why was I so angry? Where did that depression come from? Where did this reckless, almost masochistic mindset derive from? I mean, I think partly it's innate, partly it's nature. There's definitely genealogical factors. Jesus is in my heart, but my granddaddy's in my genes. But it's also nurture. I mean, I remember being a kid under the stairwell in the neighborhood we lived. I was about 7, and an older boy in the neighborhood, his name was Randy. He was about 16, 17, a lot bigger than me. And he molested me. It was not a very intimate encounter. It was more of a fondling that lasted about a minute or so. But man, did that leave a mark on me. All it took was 1 minute and it left its mark. Now, how did that leave its mark? How does that correlate to some of the things that would happen later on in my life and the anger and the just the craziness in my head? Well, you know, you lose power. You're in a situation where someone is overpowering you. You're a little kid. You can't get away. You can't get out. Fortunately, I had a friend that showed up about a minute and a half into it and intercepted the situation from going real bad. But you lose power. And now somehow that sort of creates this lust for the very thing that was taken from you. This ravenous desire for control. I mean, I remember being 10 or 11 years old. Fast forward a few years later, I was wrestling with a cousin. He was smaller than me. And I remember getting him into a headlock. And I remember I had this intoxicating feeling came over me, like I had power. I mean, power is a mind-altering drug. I mean, you think people behave bad on an acid trip, you should see what they do on a power trip. I mean, I had this power. I had this control. I have him in a headlock. And my aunt walks in, thank God. But where did that come from? Where did that aggression derive from? Well, power was taken from me. And in this situation, I'm trying to regain the very thing that's stolen from me. I find this true with a lot of inmates I work with. A lot of the people that I've spent time with, first and foremost, I believe that we're born with a sinful nature. I believe the old Christian Judeo claims that we have this beast inside of us, like straight from the gate. From the time we're born, there's something in us that will do bad. Like that dog will hunt if you give it opportunity. So I believe in the sinful nature. And I might not believe in that, but if you do look at history, you're going to see man is quite depraved and capable of some pretty bad things. So I believe in that. There's this innate sinful nature. But then I also believe these traumatic nurturing experiences leave their mark. And I've found that in my relationships with inmates, I don't know one violent offender that I have sat with that wasn't traumatized in some way and spent the rest of their life trying to regain the power that was taken from them at a young age. Also consider this. You know, when you're young and stuff happens, you're seeing the world through an egocentric lens. That's how Eric Erickson would describe it. He was a child developmental psychologist. And he says that the kid is seeing the world through this egocentric lens, which means we see ourselves as a kid as the cause of all things. Theory of mind, which means taking other people's perspectives, it hasn't blossomed yet. You can't really see things from other people's angles. So if you're egocentric as a kid, which is very typical of childhood, mom and dad divorce, it's your fault. You're sexually abused, it's your fault. Something awful happens in the environment, it's you. You did this. So you start to internalize this lie that I'm bad. I mean, I'm really bad for what happened to me to happen. It's got to be me. I mean, I did this. So now you've got this marred self-image. I'm bad. And let me tell you, if that's not the story of David Berkowitz, the son of Sam. I spent 100 hours with David Berkowitz, 34 sessions, meeting with him, describing the mental health factors behind his crimes. I mean, here's a man, if you from the New York area, you know well, shot 13 people close range in the face, lit hundreds of fires all through New York City during the 1970s, instigated the largest manhunt in New York history, 280-something police officers looking for him. And what's behind this serial killer? I mean, where does his story go back to? It goes back to early childhood. He's a kid. He's hyperactive. He can't sit still in class. He's adopted. That's a whole nother rabbit trail. A lot of shame with the adoption. But he's sitting in class and his teacher tells him to sit down. This is late 1950s, South Bronx, New York, the Soundview section. And he can't sit still. ADHD at that time is not considered a medical problem. It's seen as a moral issue. And the teacher says, you're a bad boy. She puts his desk in the center of the class and says, this is where the bad boys sit, and announces that to the classroom. And he said to me, Dr. Caparelli, I didn't want to go to school. The shame and how easily shame morphs into rage, how easily that shame becomes this hatred, this acrimony towards the world, towards women, towards, I mean, it just grew from there. So I find in working with a lot of these violent offenders, another one is Craig Price. Craig Price is the youngest serial killer in the country. Craig was arrested at 15 years old. I've met with Christ many times. You probably call, well, I shouldn't say many times, a handful of times, four or five times in person. But he calls me probably six, seven times a week. I mean, he's got nobody to talk to. These are the pariahs of society. These are the people that society says they can rot in hell. They shouldn't even be acknowledged. Okay, those are the people that, and I know this is going to fly in the face of our mainstream culture, but I believe nobody is outside the scope of hope. I reject, I emphatically reject biological fatalism, the idea that some people are pure evil, the idea that some people are outside the scope of redemption. I mean, there was an apostle a long time ago. His name was Paul. He was a murderer. He was a cold-blooded assassin. And he said in the book of Timothy in the Bible, he said, here is a trustworthy saying deserving of full acceptance. Christ came into the world to save sinners, of which I am the chief of all sinners. So, you know, you got Craig Price, you got David Berkowitz, and many of them have these early experiences, like myself. I mean, really, but for the grace of God, so go I. I can see, as I'm hearing their stories, I can see myself in this story. In fact, when I wrote David's book, I called it Monster Mirror, ranked number one on Amazon, put me on Netflix, a documentary called Conversations with a Killer. I make parallels between my life and David's life. I don't think that there's much of a distance between this so-called psychopath and the general population. But for the grace of God, I could have went in the same direction. So getting back to Craig Price, Craig, similar to David, he's a young boy. He's a black kid. And he's 5 years old. And he's babysat by a white woman. And from the age of 5 to 7, while she's babysitting him, mother trusts her. She seemed like a trustworthy woman. She puts Craig to bed, 7, 8 o'clock. And then around midnight when he's sleeping, she walks in, she picks him up, carries him from the bed into a living room area where Craig said he vaguely remembers there being other people in the living room. And he has these fragments of recollections of being sexually assaulted at this party of people while he's 5, 6, 7 years old. Now, I don't find it coincidental that his victims, 13 years old, he breaks into a woman's house and he stabs her 50-something times in the face and the chest. And then at 15 years old, white woman, at 15 years old, he breaks into a home and he kills a mother and her 2 little girls, 8-year-old girl and 10-year-old girl. Now, I'm not making excuses for Craig Price. I'm not making excuses for David Berkowitz. I think that they should stay in prison. I hold a very strict standard of justice. I don't advocate for their release. I don't write letters to parole boards. I mean, there's a difference between an excuse and an explanation. If I take that explanation and I use it to pardon these men from their consequences, to excuse, think of the verb excuse, to use that explanation to excuse them of consequences, then it's an excuse. I'm not pardoning them from their consequences. In fact, they're not even asking, or at least David Berkowitz is not asking to be released. So they accept their fate, they accept the punishment that they've received, and you know, they've committed awful crimes and they should stay right where they are. But in the meantime, while they're within the confines of the prison system, oftentimes that's where I show up. Now, I wrote David's book back in 2023. Craig read it and he had sent me an email. I had talked to him years ago. When I did prison ministry as a pastor back in the early 2000s, we connected, we developed a bond somewhere around 2004. Then the book was released. He got a copy of it. He read it. He sent me an email and he said, would you come visit me? Now, you know, it's interesting because when I'm brought in to visit with these guys, a lot of times I'm there to support them because, I believe nobody's outside the scope of hope. I believe everyone has a chance of redemption. If there's breath still in their lungs, then that means the Almighty hasn't given up on them. If God waits to judge a man to the end, who am I to judge him in the middle? So I show up. I don't show up with judgment. It's a no stones thrown zone. And I try to help them understand what went wrong. A lot of questions. I mean, they themselves, believe it or not, they've committed these awful crimes and they're often wondering, looking back retrospectively, what the heck happened? I really don't understand completely what went wrong. Where'd all this rage come from? So, you know, the relationship is often centered on that question. What went wrong? Of course, it's also there to, I'm also there to help support them in the present and walking in redemption now. Both men, Craig Price and David Berkowitz, have committed themselves to Jesus Christ. They're both walking in a faith. They're not perfect. Listen, David Berkowitz has had his character defects and still has his character defects. These are not perfect men. But I don't know anybody that's perfect. The only people that you know are perfect are the people you don't know. The only people that are perfect are the people that you haven't gotten to know yet. And I know in a cancel culture, it really puts a bullseye on my back. And man, since the book came out on David Berkowitz in 2023 and then appeared on Netflix in 2025, and the book had hit number one on Amazon the first month, boy, does it put a bullseye on your forehead in a cancel culture where people are canceled for not using pronouns correctly. Never mind calling yourself a friend or a spiritual advisor of serial killers. I told David Berkowitz, I said, listen, I said, being your friend is like being in the construction zone and there's a sign above your head and it says drop zone, watch out, rocks may fall on your head. I said, that's what friendship is like. But, you know, we all have our cross to carry. And I believe that that's my cross. I believe that that's exactly what Christ would do now. It's what he did 2,000 years ago. He bypassed the aristocracy. He walked past the religious elite. And he hung out with the fishermen, the prostitutes, the drunkards. In fact, he said to the religious, they're closer to the kingdom of God than you are. So that's my journey is I just have a heart for the pariahs. I really believe that if I had not committed my life to Christ by the age of 18, I don't know where that would have taken me. I mean, I remember being in a doctor's office at like 13 years old and the doctors taking their time. They were running late and I was in the lobby of the doctor's office and I fall asleep with my mother. She's sitting next to me. And I remember having this dark, violent fantasy, just twisted. And I remember waking up from it and going, what was that? Like, where did that come from? It scared the hell out of me. I don't know what would have become of my life. Now, I never acted out violently. I committed crimes. I did at 17, break into some houses. I did rob a couple of cars. I did get in trouble, but I never went down that road. But given enough time, providing the right set of circumstances or the wrong set of circumstances, even a Catholic nun will hit you over the head with a tire iron. I mean, anybody is capable of anything. And again, that flies in the face of our, you know, popular narrative that there are good people and bad people. And then there are the really bad people. I mean, the world is neatly divided into these categories of good and bad. And the cancel culture has not helped us at all. Right? And of course, we're part of the good population. And maybe we even want our monsters. Maybe we want to keep those monsters. Maybe they should be typecast as monsters forever. Because as long as they're the monster, it puts me in the light of the protagonist. Kind of reminds me of that scene in Scarface where Tony Montana stands up. He's this drug lord. I mean, this nasty individual. And he's looking around and he says in a drunken fit, he says, you need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your filthy finger and say, that's the bad guy. So maybe society wants to believe in biological fatalism. Maybe it wants to believe in this thing called the irredeemable psychopath, the one who's wired different. Maybe because it makes us feel better morally about whatever we got going on when the blinds are down, when it's dark, when no one's looking, whatever habit we got going on, we can say I'm bad, but I'm not that bad. I mean, I'm bad, but not that bad. Not that bad. So, you know, I think, look, I study the brain. I teach at two colleges. I teach 7 classes in psychology. I teach human growth and development. I teach criminal psych. I teach a criminal psych class at the college. I've got these violent offenders calling in on the phone. Every student wants to take the class. You know, David Berkowitz calling in on the phone, to share some of his stories and how he became what he became. I teach general psychology. I teach counseling classes. So I understand the brain. I understand the differences between, let's say, the psychopath brain and the normal brain. And there are structural differences, there's no doubt. Even genetically speaking, there's a gene called the MAOA gene. If you have that gene, which is a small percentage of men, although every man thinks they have it, it's called the warrior gene. Everyone thinks they're Liam Neeson. Every male walking the planet sees himself as Liam Neeson when he looks in the mirror. But if you have that gene, you're more prone towards extreme behavior, all or nothing mentality, unafraid of consequence, usually scoring low in emotional empathy. If you have that gene and you have the brain of a psychopath, there are differences. But behavior has more to do with wiring than it does brain structure. Now that's something worth thinking about. Because according to the teachings of neuroplasticity, I mean, you look up guys like Dr. Daniel Amen, who I've been on his show. He's a friend. He did a blurb for my book. He's a brain expert. Dr. Caroline Leaf. These are leading figures in neuroplasticity. I've been on both their shows. They'll tell you the brain is full of wires and it can be rewired. It's not in stone. It's in flux. I mean, it's constantly changing and responding and making adaptations to the environment, to the decisions we make. So are there differences in the brains of psychopaths? Sure, there are structural changes or structural distinctions, but behaviors have a lot more to do with wiring than they do these structural changes. And I have seen, working with inmates, I've seen the changes. I've seen the changes in how they engage other people, even the empathy they have. You'd be surprised at the empathy that these monsters have. Again, back to the monster narrative. We've got this narrative. I mean, I can't tell you how many documentaries I watch on some true crime incident, and there's some criminologist saying, oh, they're wired different, and he's a psychopath, and you know, I know he's 13 years old, and he committed this awful crime, but once a psychopath, always a psychopath. And I mean, it's just this push in our culture. If I heard that kind of talk as a kid with those dark thoughts, I would have wrote myself off as a hopeless case. I mean, what message are we sending to young boys, especially in a society where there are two school shootings a week, where there are a lot of young, angry men? Okay, what message are we sending to them when we tell them, if you think this way, if this is the category you fall in, if you're a psychopath, that's it. This is who you are. This is pure evil. I don't see that message as hopeful. I don't see it as encouraging. I don't see it as redemptive. I see it as destructive in our society. So once again, I boldly, emphatically reject the idea of biological fatalism, that there is a pure evil. I think everybody has a chance at redemption. And I think really the path to redemption for me, for David Berkowitz, for Craig Price, for many inmates, it begins with a faith in a higher power named Jesus Christ. But then it also plays out in the repairing of self-image. Repairing of self-image is a big one. The breaking of isolation. These men oftentimes are isolated. I don't mean isolated in the hermit sense of the word. Like the Ted Kaczynski, you know, in a cabin somewhere in the Midwest with a long, unkempt beard, isolated from society. I mean, Craig Price was a class clown. David Berkowitz grew up in the most populated city in the world, New York City. But there's a difference between being with people and bonding with people. These men knew how to be with people, but they didn't know how to bond with people. And in that isolation, in that hollow vacuum, outside of community, with a very warped self-image, don't underestimate the darkness of fantasies that can run through someone's mind. So I get a chance to see some of these crazy or formerly crazy people, you know, find their path to redemption, reacclimate within the prison system. Maybe that's the only place that they can do it. So be it. Maybe it's too much for them to be in the real world. I'm not arguing that at all, that's probably the case with many. But within the confines of that prison, they're able to develop relationships. I can't tell you how many times I've sat with David Berkowitz and he says to me, can we pray right now? There's an inmate by the name of Charles who his son just died and he's really hurting, Mike. Can we pray for Charles? Now you might say, well, that's manipulation. That's what they do, psychopaths. They manipulate. Any pro-social behavior, just chalk it up to manipulation. What does he get out of that? What is David Berkowitz, what is he accomplishing out of somehow manipulating me into believing that he's this empathetic person? I've worked with inmates long enough to know the difference between the genuine artifact, like the real sincere remorse and conversion, and the jailhouse conversion. There are a lot of jailhouse conversions. I won't debate that. There are. Okay? Whether they're doing it for parole board, whatever reason they're doing it. But you don't throw away your real money because there's counterfeit monies in circulation. I'm not throwing away, I'm not becoming so cynical that I can't detect the genuine artifact because there are so many counterfeits out there. I think that the cynical viewpoint is a viewpoint that is destroying our nation, questioning, putting under scrutiny anybody that does anything good. Okay, it's a little bit of a puff of our own pride. It's a little bit of an elevation of our own sense of morality. And it's a constant judgment and questioning of the people around us. And I just don't see that as the way of Christ. It certainly wasn't the way I took. And I thank God for Pastor Mike Krautmann, died 2 years ago, who went into that juvenile jail. I mean, he loved those inmates. In fact, Craig Price was in that same juvenile jail that I was in, maybe 5 years prior to me. He's about 5 years older, about 53. But Pastor Mike reached out to Craig Price. He reached out to me. He reached out to so many pariahs, people that society wrote off. My passion in life is to help the pariahs, to reach out to the outcasts, the people that nobody else wants. Not because I'm advocating for their release, not because I'm trying to make excuses for them, but because that very likely could have been me had not God intervened at a very young age.
What do you think? There are so many more just in the last 10, 20 years. They're not necessarily serial killers, but like, you know, school shootings and things like that, which are similar.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing a lot of school shootings, anger, especially within young men, especially within young white men. There's a lot of answers to that question. I think one of the answers, one of many, so please don't think I'm reducing it to this one thing. We live in a very individualistic society. You don't really see these phenomenons within collectivist nations. When I say collectivist nations, I mean nations where the community ties are strong. And I've been around the world. I've been in Europe, Africa. I was in Ghana this summer. I spoke at Sunyani University, which is a university downtown Ghana. They wanted me to come in and speak on mental health.
Are other countries having problems like we are?
Not to the degree of the Western society. Western society is very individualistic. There's a loneliness in our society. There's an isolation. And we're social creatures. Like I don't care how introverted you are listening to this broadcast, you're still a social creature. You got 83 billion neurons in your brain. One third of those neurons are mirror neurons, which mirror neurons are what enables you to feel what people feel, laugh when they laugh, cry the way they cry. Social connection, that's how we're made. We're made for social connectivity. Outside of that social context, in a very individualistic society where we put me above we, collectivist society, it's we above me. In an individualistic society, it's me above we. You can kind of pick up on this in the heroic narrative of that society, which shows up in movies, books, songs. You know, in an individualistic society, the hero is the guy that does whatever he wants and just does this to the community. That's what we celebrate in our society. In a collectivist society, it's the one that lays his rights down. I mean, he lays his life down for the tribe, for the family, for the team. That's a collectivist nation. So America, especially with social media, has become very much, look at me. Okay, it's me above we. Even if it means doing very bad things. In fact, if you look at a lot of the school shooters, there's always this, not always, but a lot of times there's this Magna Carta. Like there's this speech that they're going to make, whether it's written down in a diary or a website is created or some videos left. And it's just this me above the community. It's this, you know, it's this elevation of self. And that happens usually more in an individualistic society like America than you see in some of your collectivist nations. I really believe the answer, part of the answer of healing, in addition to faith in God, is a community. It's relationships. Okay, we were damaged in relationships, and we're healed in the context of relationships. We need relationships to heal. In fact, that's what I find with the inmates. I find the more they get involved in their Bible studies and the support groups, the more they're involved in the social landscape of the prison, they begin to heal. I mean, it's no surprise. Christ gave two commandments. Love the Lord your God. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. So it's in that context of relationship between God and people. That's where the change and the redemption begins to happen. And in many cases, these young men you're referring to, they're social misfits. They're the people that just, they're socially maladjusted, don't quite fit in. In the case of Craig Price, class clown, but felt alienated still. Even though he got along with everybody, he was, you know, center of attention. He was a black kid in a predominantly white neighborhood. He still felt like an alien. Now, there's a lot of other factors that go into the recipe of violence. I'm not reducing it to that, but that's one piece. David Berkowitz, socially maladjusted, adopted, hyperactive, one of the only adopted kids in his neighborhood. A little awkward if you get to know him socially. Just not quite. One might put him on the autism spectrum. I'm not saying he is, but one might do that, observing some of his behaviors. So that kind of, it makes one feel disconnected. And that disconnection, it's a breeding ground. That social isolation is a breeding ground. It's an incubator for a lot of dark thoughts and a lot of, you know, terrible fantasies that can come in one's mind. I mean, I go back to the Bible, the book of Genesis. God creates Adam. And then right after he creates him, he makes a statement. He says, it is not good for Adam to be alone, and I will make him a helper. My imagination, I think, what was Adam doing for God to say that? Was he chasing a pigeon with a stick? Was he hitting his head up against a tree? Like, at some point, it got so bad. I'm being facetious. God looks down and says, he needs a friend. Like, he needs a friend quick. So we're social creatures. If you put us on an island alone, we're going to find a volleyball, paint a face on it, and call it Wilson. And if that volleyball should leave somehow, we are going to go absolutely berserk. We need social connection. And I see these inmates find the healing they need. I see them find the transformation as they get involved in community, as they become a part of the social landscape.
Mm. The outcast, misfit label that you give people, give some of these guys, is that something that is a product of social media, of our new technology, of how the world has changed with you know, especially a lot of these guys are probably unable to have relationships with women.
Social media has not helped. I mean, the rules of engagement for your digital relationship are not the same thing as your rules of engagement for the face-to-face relationship. So it stands to reason, the more time I spend in digital reality, the more I lose social grace, I lose that ability to connect face-to-face. I mean, think about it. You got all the control with digital reality. I mean, if we get into a fight, I can block you. I can ghost you. If I don't like the way I look, I can put a filter on my face. Some people got more filters than Keurig. I can put a filter on my face. I mean, I can make myself look any way I want to. You say something nasty to me, if I need some space from it, I can back up, think about what I want to say, go for a walk. I can get brazen, get nasty, not be afraid of what the consequence is. So the more I'm engaging in that digital reality where I have a lot of control, and now I'm face to face with someone, I can't control how I look. They're seeing how I look. I don't got all this space to time out my reactions. I mean, it's in real time now. There's a lot of pressure here. I mean, I can see it with some of the students in the college. You can tell some of them have been like in mom's basement on YouTube for the last 50 hours, and they approach the desk to ask me a question about the paper, and it's like, you know, they're like shaking. I'm like, it's okay, come on. Just this, you know, this inability to socially engage people face to face because of complete baptism, full immersion into the world of digital reality. So I don't see digital reality helping the situation at all. I'm not like saying digital reality is the devil. I think it can be used for great good. But like anything else, you need discipline. It needs moderation. You know, you need a level of control over it, or it's going to control you.
What do you think would help us as a society, especially in the West?
I think there's such incredible value in hearing people's stories. I mean, I love Soft White Underbelly. And Mark didn't tell me to say this, by the way. I'm not getting any check for saying this. Mark's last name, Leda, means to enlighten in Latin. I looked that up this morning. Soft White Underbelly has enlightened the population to people's stories from all walks of life. You know, whether it's a kid with transgenderism or some lady off the street, some crip or whatever. Hearing people's stories face to face, that's a game changer. I mean, you could hate somebody. You can't stand their guts. You sit down with them over a cup of coffee. Tell me how it works for you in maintaining that grudge after you sit with them face to face for 15 minutes and hear this story. Tell me what happens to the grudge. Okay. Stanley Milgram did a fascinating experiment back in the 50s, right after World War II. A lot of social experiments were done in the late 40s, 1950s, because we had just uncovered the atrocities of the Holocaust. And the scientific community thought it was a German problem. They didn't realize it was a human problem until they began to run all these social experiments. And one of the experiments, Milgram, it's called blind obedience to authority. But an authority figure is telling someone to administer electrical shocks to another person. Okay, the other person is an actor, but the subject of the experiment doesn't know that. And they're able to administer shocks even to the point of fatality if somebody in authority is asking them to do it. Well, Milgram's experiment was replicated 100 times. One of those replications, they actually had the subject of the experiment look at the person's face that they were shocking. And all of a sudden, the ability to shock that person, like the percentage of subjects that could shock someone, it dropped significantly. Because once you're face to face with someone, you hear this story, those mirror neurons kick in. Empathy, oxytocin, which is the biological substrate of empathy, oxytocin goes up. You start to feel warm towards that person. It's very hard to hurt someone whom you empathize with. Very hard to hurt someone who is right in front of you. So I think more and more of that face-to-face contact, and less of the distance between us, which social media has created, would go a long way. I mean, even David Berkowitz, I remember asking Dave, I said, was there anybody you couldn't hurt when you were out of your mind back in 1976 to 77, terrorizing New York City? He said, that's an interesting question you ask. He said, because I remember driving in January 1977. I leave the post office. He worked at the post office. I leave the post office at midnight. The gun is in my glove compartment, the .44 caliber revolver. And I cruise through New York City looking for a victim. He said, and in the process of doing that, on one winter night in New York, a car is stuck in a snowbank. Here I am looking for a victim. And the girl's outside the car and she's waving me down. She has no idea she's waving down the son of Sam, the guy whose name is in the newspapers. I mean, every headline, you know, in New York City had his crimes. He pulls over. He hears her voice. He sees her face. He said, I couldn't hurt her. He actually pulled the car out of the snowbank. He actually went to his trunk. He had an emergency kit. Took the emergency kit out, pulled the car out of the snowbank, waved her goodbye, and went looking for his next victim. Go put that together in your perspective of psychopaths. They got no empathy. I agree they have low empathy. And I would agree that the crimes themselves are the antithesis of empathy. That's for sure. I mean, sadism to the max in many cases. But you'd be surprised. I mean, I look at the human being and I see traces of the image of God. Even though there's sometimes that image of God, that imago Dei, as they say in Latin, that image of God might be buried under a pile of just nastiness. There are hints of it. It's still there. You could say, well, David was, he was manipulating. He's a psychopath. He's being charming in that setting with that young lady. Well, is that really the sensible explanation for why he stopped and he helped her? His explanation is, once that empathy kicked in, once I saw her face to face, it's very hard to hurt somebody when you're face to face with them. Very difficult. There's a story in the Bible about a Pharaoh who ordered the killing of all Hebrew male babies. Okay, and he told all the midwives in that time period, he says, I want you to kill every Hebrew male baby. And Pharaoh had a daughter. And that daughter, you know, she's obviously she's obedient to dad. She's going to do whatever dad says. Okay, dad says kill all the Hebrew male babies. And then one day she's by the Nile River. She's taking a bath and a basket floats across the Nile River. And in the basket is this Jewish baby named Moses. And the Pharaoh's daughter is holding baby Moses. Dad said, kill all the male babies. Kill all the Jewish male babies. She's holding one now. It's hard to hurt someone you're holding. Well, that baby Moses grows up in the palace of Pharaoh, becomes a son to Pharaoh, becomes a son to Pharaoh's daughter. Point being, when the love grows cold between us, when that empathy erodes, and I think we're experiencing an erosion of empathy in our society, when it runs at an all-time low deficit, that itself paves the way for unspeakable crimes, for atrocities.
My motivation for when I started Softwood Underbelly was to create understanding, which brings forgiveness and empathy and compassion. And I think just by hearing people's stories, by sitting and listening to them, you begin to understand why a person is the way they are. Rather than just hating them because they're black or hating them because they're, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think the color issue, we've come a long way with that. Although there's still a long way to go. But when it comes to people that have committed the crimes that David Berkowitz and Craig Price have committed, the hatred, the vitriol.
Yeah, but aren't all victims become predators?
Well, I wouldn't say all victims become predators, but yeah, let's say it this way. Let's say it this way. All predators, or a large percentage of them, okay, I won't say all.
Yeah.
Large percentage of them were victims.
There you go.
Yeah, so.
That's the way to say it.
You know, you've got these people in prison, and, you know, what really bugs me is, once again, me doing what I do, being who I am, it puts me in this drop zone, rocks may fall on your head. Place where there's a lot of, I mean, the amount of death threats, emails I've gotten, nasty letters, comments, even stuff directed at my kids on social media because I've befriended some of the worst people. Oftentimes, the general public will put you in this, what logicians will call false dilemma or false dichotomy, where if you have compassion towards the prisoner, that automatically means you show no regard for the victim. That's a false dichotomy. That is just not true. Okay, but that's what's generated through the responses, through the trolls that, you know, comment under videos like this, is what about the victims? Well, let me tell you about the victims. I've spent just as much time in my life ministering to the victims as I have those in prison. In fact, I don't see hatred and vitriol towards the perpetrators as helpful to the victims. Okay, I don't see that as helpful. If anything, I think it fuels any resentment they may have inside. It blocks them from the path of forgiveness. So the idea that I can't befriend the David Berkowitz and at the same time show compassion towards his victims and families, that I can't do those two things, that is a false dichotomy. But we live in a society where logic, critical thinking is at an all-time low. So people will put that up and there'll be a, you know, there'll be a whole like parade of people that'll come behind that and say, yeah, what about the victims? Well, I'm friends with Carl DiNaro. Carl DiNaro was shot in the head by David Berkowitz in 1976. He survived. Carl DiNaro and myself went into the prison together and met David Berkowitz. I sat in the middle. Carl sat on the left. David Berkowitz sat on the right. These two men for 3 hours while I was in the middle of it. I actually helped organize the meeting. I watched them show empathy towards each other. Can you imagine that? Being shot in the head and showing empathy towards the person that shot you. Okay? So to say that, you know, you can't show compassion to the prisoners, at the same time have compassion towards the victims, only in a simplistic worldview can you say something like that. That's just not correct.
But what reaction did Berkowitz have to that?
Well, he was sweating for a long time. He asked for the meeting. He said, can you set this up? Carl had written a book called The Son of Sam and Me. I would highly recommend it. Carl's belief is that David was not alone in the shootings. He was a part of a cult. David has rejected that and said, no, I did the killings. Carl has his reasons for that theory. I would definitely recommend buying the book and seeing his version of the story. But David was, if you could put yourself in his shoes, I mean, he was sweating bullets. It was a lot of anticipation that went into the meeting, probably about maybe 5 or 6 weeks from the time David asked me to set it up and the time the meeting actually happened. I mean, to see them at the end of the meeting, hold hands, the three of us, and pray. And then when it came time for the photographer to take a photo of us, David stands to my right. Carl is coming to stand next to David. David whispers in my ear, maybe I should stand on your other side, Mike. And Carl sees David about to move on that side of me. And he grabs him. He pulls him towards him. And we take this photo with David in the middle, David's victim, who he shot in the head, to his right, and me to his left. So, you know, the world is messy. Like, I think we really need to add a little nuance to our understanding of human behavior and our worldview, and not be so quick to pit people up against people and pit sides up against sides. Once again, goes back to, in my opinion, an empathy deficit. There's just an empathy deficit. And it's a beautiful thing to see the work of God, really the work of Jesus, in the life of both the inmates, the perpetrators of the crimes, and also see healing in the victims.
Forgiveness is powerful.
I can't see any other way other than forgiveness. I mean, if you don't forgive it, you relive it. I mean, you continually relive it. Not forgiving it, it's like you're shackled to the person who hurt you. They could be dead, but they're in your head. And every day you wake up and they're in your head. Every night you go to bed, they're in your head. You meet people that remind you of them. You hate the person that's in front of you because they're reminding you of the person that hurt you. Until you forgive, I mean, forgiveness is really breaking that shackle between you and the perpetrator.
All right, Michael Carparelli, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on what you've been done for work for the last, how many years, 20, 30 years?
I started ministry in 2004 full-time, so it's been 22 years. Mm. 20 years of working with violent offenders in the prisons.
What would you say is the most important thing you've learned in all of this?
I understand the vitriol towards people like David Berkowitz, Craig Price, your school shooters. We live in a culture of outrage. People are outraged by the crimes committed by the individuals we talked about. I don't see it as profitable. I don't see the vitriol as profitable to the culture at large. I don't see it as profitable to the victims themselves. You know, back in the 16th century, there was an English reformer. His name was John Bradford. And in those days, they would publicly execute a man. All the town people would come out in England, and they would do what you see today on social media. They would hurl insults, spit, throw things at the criminal. And John Bradford, who was a Christian minister, he stood up amidst this crowd of people screaming, you know, legitimate statements at this criminal being executed for murder. And Bradford stands up, he points to the man, and he says, "There but for the grace of God, so go I." We think that there are other people. Other people will shoot up schools. Other people will commit murder. There are no other people. That's my number one lesson in the last 22 years, is people of people. We're all sinners and we all need a savior.
All right. Michael, what are the names of your books?
On Amazon, you can get Monster Mirror. That's the book about David Berkowitz that was featured in Netflix. I have about five other books on mental health. You just look up my name and you'll find the books.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mike.